Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Katie Hausman, Associate Professor at the University of Michigan and an expert on electricity and energy markets. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start very broadly with the topic of environmental and energy justice, since these issues have really come to the forefront in light of recent events and also given Joe Biden's prioritization of these issues since the election. Earlier this year, you co-authored a paper titled Inequality, Information Failures, and Air Pollution with your colleague Samuel Stolper. Could you discuss some of the key findings of the report and potential recommendations for addressing energy and environmental inequity in frontline communities?
I'd love to, because that's a topic that Sam and I care a lot about. And as you said, there's a real push nationwide to think about how to make sure that we're designing climate policies and energy policies that are equitable and just, and that don't disadvantage the communities that are already struggling with racism and with economic inequality. Communities of color and low-income communities are the communities that have historically borne the highest pollution burdens for a number of reasons. And it's really important to keep that in mind going forward as we design policies around energy transitions, for instance. What motivated us for that particular paper was noting that there are so many instances where pollution was worse than we thought, worse than the public in general thought. And it's really hard to get timely and accurate and comprehensive information about pollution damages in different neighborhoods. And that's not through the fault of any particular communities. In fact, frontline communities, as I'm sure you know, are working really hard to get high quality information about the risks that they face. It's more a function of the way that science advances and the way that we do monitoring in this country, and sometimes the way that regulations happen. And so what that means is because industrial sites are located in these communities, when we find out pollution was worse than we thought, those are the communities that are most harmed by us not having known about historically just how bad things were. And so the communities that are hurt by this gap in information are precisely the ones that have fewer economic resources to deal with the health impacts that arise because of it. So this is not the only problem in environmental justice. This is just a piece of the puzzle, but it's one that we thought was important to highlight going forward.
Great, thank you. So the report itself focused a lot on pollution issues, and I think that's one of the key aspects of environmental justice campaigns is mitigating the pollution issues. But there's also another side to environmental and energy justice, and that's the energy access and resilience point as well. And I think there are a couple ways that nuclear energy could potentially fit into environmental and energy justice. So I'd like to hear your thoughts, more broadly speaking, on what role you think nuclear energy could play in improving energy access and environmental justice for these communities.
You're right, it's not just environmental justice. There's three different sort of co-mingled movements right now around climate justice, around energy justice, and around environmental justice. And those don't always totally align, although you know, a well-designed policy would want to take into account all three. So what's the role for nuclear in all three of those, I think, is the right question to ask. And I guess a lot depends on the policy choices that get made, right? So in theory, in a blackboard situation where you're designing things optimally, you could imagine that a well-designed regulatory framework that puts in a bunch of nuclear power plants and keeps open safe existing power plants would allow us to transition away from the fossil fuel plants that have polluted low-income communities and communities of color for decades. And that could be a win-win for energy, environmental, and climate justice, and also for keeping costs low for lots of different things. But as I said, it depends on the way that policy gets enacted and the way that the regulatory framework takes place. So you need to make sure that you're doing that in a way that's not overly expensive, because as you said, there's concerns about being able to pay for energy. And also that doesn't lead to higher risks for people living near nuclear plants. And of course, that very hot button topic of what to do with spent fuel, you got to figure out a just way to do that. So in theory, it's possible, but it depends on how we do it.
Okay, and then in terms of these policy frameworks that you mentioned, I sort of want to shift focus a little bit towards a particular policy option that we've been hearing a bit more about in recent days. And it's also relevant because you have a sort of funny YouTube video out there that compares carbon taxes to a swear jar. So I'd like to ask you a bit about carbon taxes and the nuances of these measures, whether it's a carbon tax, a fee, or a dividend, and what type of impact they might have on nuclear energy.
Yeah, so that video you mentioned, it's on my website. If you're interested in finding a 3-minute explainer on carbon pricing, it does not get into the nuance, but we do we cite some sources that would allow you to get the more nuanced view of some of those questions, but it tries to encapsulate some of the benefits of carbon pricing in a short 3-minute video. So carbon pricing is not the only toolkit that we should have in our climate protection. It's not the only tool we should have in our climate protection toolkit, but it can be a really useful and important one, which is what I'm trying to highlight in that video. So the basic idea is that you want polluters to pay for the societal cost of the damages from their pollution. So if somebody is burning coal to produce electricity or burning natural gas to produce electricity or combusting gasoline to fuel a vehicle, you want them to be responsible for the fact that that is contributing to sea level rise, to hurricane, damages in the future, to wildfire risk, to all of those things. So you're trying to find a way to make people monetarily responsible for the value to the economy and to people's health that their actions are doing. And the simplest way to do it is probably by putting the price upstream on upstream producers. It's not like I actually literally put money into a swear jar every time that I drive my car, but you make the producers of oil and gas and coal pay for those damages. And then that price feeds through the whole economy so that my driving prices are higher. And I think about that. And sometimes I don't drive as far, or I take the bus, or I walk, or what have you. So there's a lot of nuance in how you want to enact such a policy. I said that you're making people like me pay more when they drive, so you want to make sure that you find a way to do that that's equitable. In doing that, you're raising funds, right? Either through selling off permits for pollution or through implementing a tax scheme, you're raising a bunch of money, and you can use that to do things like protect frontline communities that we talked about with environmental justice before, or protect rural communities that by the nature of the way their spaces need to drive more, to implement R&D programs for new technological advances. There's a lot of things that you can do with that money depending on what your goals are for the economy and for people's well-being. So that's the basic summary.
So I just wanted to follow up really quickly on that. So is there a best approach to ensure that frontline communities or low-income communities or communities of color aren't inequitably affected by a carbon fee? So would that be, would that be best implemented in terms of a carbon dividend, or is there some other mechanism to ensure that?
I think the dividend has gotten the widest support from academics and also from some advocacy groups, because it allows you to do it in a way where you're still keeping the incentive in place to reduce pollution, but you're also protecting those communities. So there's great research out there from academics, and there's also nice policy proposals from advocates out on a fee and dividend approach, like you said.
Okay, thank you. And I want to shift focus a little bit to the economics of nuclear power plants. So some of your research in the past has focused on this, as well as the market impacts of premature closures, as well as corporate incentives for nuclear safety mechanisms. What are some of the key insights that you've gained from your research about the competitiveness of nuclear energy from an economic standpoint, as well as an energy and climate resilience perspective?
I think the main insight that came out for me of some of my first work on this was that it's more nuanced than some sides of the debate might have you believe, either the super pro-nuclear or the super anti-nuclear voices. And it's been refreshing to see recently that there are a lot of sort of middle line voices talking about pros and cons of nuclear power. So one of the nuances that you wanna sort of think about one of the things you wanna distinguish is between keeping open existing older nuclear plants in the US versus building new nuclear plants. And when we talk about building new ones, are we talking about building ones that are similar to what we've built before? Or are we talking about development of new technologies? So I think we want to separate out the way that we talk about those three. And the reason for that is that a power plant of any kind, nuclear, fossil, or whatever, has three different kinds of costs. It has construction costs and like the upfront capital costs and the financing costs associated with that. It's got fuel costs, which depend on like how much you generate over time. And then it's got the costs just of existing, of staying open, things like security and meeting safety regulations and all of that. And those three cost buckets are different, whether we're talking about existing plants or about new plants. And so like how competitive is a nuclear plant? You need to tell me whether you're talking about a new one or an existing one. And also where in the country are you talking about building it or where worldwide? So in terms of the existing fleet, what I saw in my research with Lucas Davis at Berkeley is that there are a lot of plants in the US that have seen their profits erode from fracking and the drop in natural gas prices we've seen since then. I think you've had somebody on your series who's talked a little bit about that. And so even though nuclear plants still face really low fuel costs, they've got these high, regulatory and security costs that mean as wholesale electricity prices are falling, it's just a lot harder to stay in business. But at the same time, like their capital costs were already paid, they're sunk, it's done. And so you could imagine that some climate policies could allow more nuclear plants to stay open because they would help sort of prop up those profits, but in a way that makes economic sense, in a way that's saying you're not putting out CO2 emissions from your generation, you're already built, and so maybe it makes sense to keep you open. In contrast, when we think about new plants, we've seen these tremendous cost overruns, not only in the US, but abroad. It seems like the cost of building a new plant is still just so astronomically high that you would need a really high carbon price to justify building much new nuclear in the US, given the way wholesale electricity prices are right now and what the costs are of building a new, a new large nuclear plant in the US. Lucas, my co-author, has another paper looking at that and pointing out that carbon prices in the range of what we've talked about in the US or Canada or Europe just would not be enough to make new nuclear profitable in the US. But then we've also got, all this excitement around small modular reactors and new reactors with passive safety measures and other kinds of new nuclear technology. So you could imagine that changing in the future. I think it's too soon to say with any confidence that we're like ready for that to, to go forward profitably.
Okay, so when you say the cost of new builds in the US, the new nuclear plants just wouldn't be competitive, you're referring primarily to Generation 3 traditional, yep. light water reactors that we've been seeing.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, so something that is sort of a hot topic in the nuclear energy community right now is the closure of the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant in California. But before we talk about that, I want to talk about a closure a few years ago of the San Onofre generating station. And you've also published research on this, in which you determined that in the 12 months following the closure, natural gas generation costs increased by $350 million. And there were other negative effects, including binding transmission constraints, that caused short-run inefficiencies and potentially made it more profitable for certain plants to act in a non-competitive manner. Could you sort of tease out some of these details and explain what your findings were?
Yeah, so we were motivated with that paper to look at two different aspects of the San Onofre plant. Lucas and I were in California at the time. He still is, now I'm in Michigan. But we were motivated by two different things. One is the sort of general economics of existing nuclear in the US, especially in a post-fracking world. And I've spoken about that already. The San Onofre closure, you know, had a lot of parallels with other plants around the US that are thinking of closing. It was not very profitable for San Onofre to stay open anymore. And when it closed, what came online to replace it was natural gas. Like, existing natural gas plants just needed to generate more and a lot more because San Onofre was big. It was like 8% of California's generation. So as other plants close, that's what you should expect to see in the short run, that gas or maybe coal is going to be needed to fill in that generation, and that's going to mean higher CO2 emissions. And so that's something I worry about, like, worldwide. You know, worldwide, if the existing nuclear fleet completely closed down tomorrow, we would have billions more metric tons of CO2 being emitted every year. It would be something like on the order of CO2 emissions from, what is it, Germany, Italy, the UK, and France all combined. I think I have that list right. Let me double check. Germany, France, Italy, and the UK combined. So that would be a big problem from the climate perspective. The other thing that interested us specifically about San Onofre was that you could see the way the transmission system operating and grid reliability in California really changing when San Onofre closed. And so we wanted to dig into that more because it was just like interesting from an energy markets perspective. But because the plant had been so big and because it had been located between two demand centers, high demand centers, the LA area and the San Diego area, it had played this important role in grid reliability. And so when it closed, dispatch order around the state needed to change to maintain things around grid reliability. And that meant that generation costs went up like above and beyond what you would expect to see just from natural gas having to fill in for the closure of this nuclear plant. So the biggest chunk of costs that increased when San Onofre closed were having to burn natural gas to generate electricity. But on top of that, there were these costs associated with the dispatch order and grid reliability. That was the main thing that we focused on in that paper. You wouldn't expect to see that at every plant. But the plants are so big that it is worth thinking ahead of time about what's going to happen when one of them closes.
And then, speaking of these reliability issues, we've been hearing a lot about this in California, especially since the summer with the wildfires. And so this has created some debate around the impending closure of the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant in California. Do you see any similarities or potential similarities between the closures of San Onofre and the impending closure of Diablo Canyon?
There are some things about California that have really changed since San Onofre closed that would make things, you know, that might make you think that the impacts will be different, and some things are the same. So it's still the case that, you know, a lot of that lost generation is going to be made up by natural gas powered plants. California has lots of wind and solar, but those plants are already generating as much as they can. So it's not like they're going to generate more to fill in for Diablo. So you should expect that we're going to see, you know, more natural gas fired plants coming on, not coming online newly, but generating more to make up for it. But at the same time, when San Onofre closed, cap and trade was not yet underway in California, versus now we do have this cap and trade program. And so that's going to put guardrails, I think, on how much, how much CO2 emissions can change by the nature of a cap and trade system. That's one of the things you get with a cap and trade system, is more certainty about how much carbon dioxide gets emitted, in a region within a year.
And what will the general trends be for reliability as a result of cap and trade?
So that's another one of the things that's really changed since San Onofre closed is, as you mentioned, there's all these new reliability concerns. And my friends in California have really been struggling with their power outages in ways that they weren't when I was in grad school there. So I've not done research on that. I'm sure that there are brilliant minds in California working on this, but it's definitely something to consider.
All right, this was really fascinating. Thank you so much for your insight on California specifically and just nuclear energy and environmental justice more broadly. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.